This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Rachel Iacovone. Later this hour, we'll hear from a woman who was sexually assaulted when she was 15. She took the perpetrator to court, and she took her story to the page in her recently published memoir called I Have the Right To. But first, the prevalence of sexual assault has risen greatly in the public consciousness over the course of the last year as the Me Too movement continues to gain steam. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so we're sitting down today with a veteran sex crimes prosecutor to get her sense of the situation, having been through so many cases over the years. Stacey Honowitz has been a supervisor in the sex crimes unit at the Broward County State Attorney's Office for nearly 25 years, and she's author of two books on the subject of child molestation that are specifically meant to be read with young children and to help parents frankly discuss inappropriate touching with their kids and teach the importance of speaking up and reporting abuse. She joins us by phone from Miami. Stacey, thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are talking about sexual assault and abuse on today's show with veteran prosecutor Stacey Honowitz. If you'd like to participate in our discussion, the lines are open. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Stacey, how much has your job changed over the decades in terms of the cases you see come across your desk?
Well, certainly it's 30 years, almost 28 years just in this unit. I've seen the amount of cases increase, and we're seeing much younger kids getting involved in this. I shouldn't say getting involved, actually being victims of this. But we're also seeing a lot more people speaking up. You know, years ago when I first started doing it, certainly the unit had enough cases, but we didn't see as many children coming forward, as many kids who were engaged in sports because their coaches were doing things. Now we're really starting to see that, and I think it's because it's becoming much more mainstream, unfortunately. We're seeing so much of it on the news. We're hearing about it. We're seeing Olympic athletes themselves that are victims, that people aren't afraid to speak up as much as they used to be.
So do you think the rate itself has increased at all, or was it just the reporting that has?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think that with what goes on in society, I think that the access to pornography now, I think the idea that people are on TV and doing certain things, you know, I think that in combination with people not being afraid has really brought these crimes to the forefront. You know, it used to be so unusual that you'd read about anything like this in the newspaper or see anything about this on the news. Now you put on the news every day, you open the paper, you open, you know, you go online, you see all these things. The first thing that you see is about sexual abuse or a sexual predator. You know, it's not so difficult anymore to try to find these cases. They're kind of right there in front of you.
So what kind of cases are you specifically dealing with?
Well, in the sex crime unit, we deal with everything. So I deal with all child molestations, child rape, sexual battery, and adult rapes. And sexual battery. So anything involving kids and sex and adults and sex, our unit handles. I see a lot more now of the child sexual abuse cases. Like I said, you know, there's a time you never heard about a female teacher having sex with a male student. If you did, it was kept quiet. People just kind of said, oh, there's a teacher. She's a nice-looking teacher, and she seems to be friendly with this kid. Well, now, you know, some of the biggest cases we have are female teachers and male students. We see coaches. We see track coaches and swim coaches and gymnastics coaches. So, you know, the difference in these cases now is that they're coming in kind of fast and furious, where before, you know, they weren't. It took a lot to get a kid to talk. It took a lot to get somebody to come to court, to want to come to a court and talk in front of a judge and a jury. Now we're seeing that it's a little bit easier. It's easier for the cases to be committed, and it's easier now for the kids to come in and talk about it.
Well, how often do they end up in court versus maybe a plea deal?
I wish I could answer that question. I wish I had percentages for you, but I don't. And that's because every single case is different. People always ask me, how do you categorize certain cases? How many cases do you go to trial on? Every case is different. I could tell you that I'm going to go to trial on Tuesday, and an hour beforehand it pleads because the parents don't want to go forward or the child decides that he can't come to court. Every case has its own set of facts, own set of issues, own set of idiosyncrasies, and so I can't give you I can't give you a number. I can't categorize how many go to trial because I could tell you in a month I'm going to go to trial on 15, and then all of a sudden, you know, 12 of them plead out.
Well, how about, let's talk charges specifically. Later in the show, we're talking with a young woman who was sexually assaulted when she was 15. The perpetrator was originally charged with felony sexual assault, but ended up convicted of misdemeanor sexual assault. Can you explain the difference in those charges and all the other related charges when it comes to sex crimes?
Okay. Well, you know, in Florida and most of the other states, the charges are different depending upon the child's age, depending upon the defendant's age, and depending upon what charges, what actual sexual acts took place. So I can speak to Florida, and I can tell you in Florida, if someone is penetrated and the victim is under the age of 12, then it's a mandatory life sentence. There's, you know, unless you plead it down because the victim doesn't want to testify or your case isn't what you thought it was, it is a mandatory life sentence. The judge is tied to that. Between the ages of 12 and 16, and if the person is over the age of 18, it's called lewd and lascivious battery. And that means that the person, doesn't matter if the person wanted to engage in sex, wanted to be involved, it's basically statutory rape, which means that because the child was under the age of 16, it doesn't matter. It's an automatic lewd and lascivious battery or sexual battery. Anything over that that's non-consensual, non-consensual sexual assault, if you have an adult on the stand that says, I did not want to have sex, I did not consent to this, that is sexual battery. So every state has different statutes on the books, and every state talks about what charges can be filed. And it does depend on what I said, what the sexual acts are and the age of the victim. So you will go to trial sometimes on a case of sexual battery, and then there'll be lesser included offenses that maybe the jury can come back on. Maybe if they don't believe one of the elements of the crime was committed, they'll come back on a misdemeanor instead of a felony charge. So every time you go into court, every time you indict somebody, you can indict them on certain charges, and then when the evidence is all there or collected or you go into court, the jury can come back on a different charge. Certainly sexually involved, but a lesser included offense.
So how about all the colloquial terminology for things, like rape versus sexual assault, for example, victim versus survivor? How do you navigate those?
Well, listen, you know, everybody thinks that the charges of rape and sexual assault and sexual battery all take on different meanings. Quite frankly, it just means that in different states, it's the same crime, just called something different. In Florida, we used to call it rape. We have since changed it to sexual battery. In some states, they still call it child endangerment, where down here we call it child neglect. So you really have to see what the facts are, and in any way you look at it, if the facts measure up to that crime, it really doesn't matter what you call it. So like I said, down here, it's capital sexual battery or sexual battery on a child when someone's under the age of 12. It might be felony sexual battery in another state. And how we talk about victim and survivor, you know, it's really how they choose to call themselves. You know, sometimes when you have somebody in your office, and you'll say to them, well, you were the victim of, they're very quick to change it and say, no, I'm the survivor. So as the prosecutor, I don't give them a name. If I call them a name and they're not happy with it, I don't mean calling a name in a nasty way, but if something that they don't feel comfortable with, then we don't use it. It's really all up to the person who's been violated. If you want to choose to call yourself the victim of the crime, that's fine. If you choose to say, I am a victim, but I've survived it, I want to be called a survivor. So that's how we navigate it.
We are talking about sexual assault and abuse on today's show with veteran prosecutor Stacey Honowitz. If you'd like to participate in our discussion, the lines are open. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Stacey, how do you handle dealing with such difficult issues day in and day out?
Well, I eat a lot of chocolate, I can tell you that much. That hasn't been good for my weight. But, you know, it's so important to be able to kind of have a rapport with the people that are coming in. You know, you have to realize, and I think most people do realize, this is such a delicate and discreet crime. You know, you're talking about violation of your private parts. You're talking about having to come to court and talk about it in front of strangers and a judge and a jury and a court reporter and the media. So many times the press gets involved in cases like this. So, you know, I try to make the witnesses, the victims or survivors, as you will, feel as comfortable as they can in having to deal with a very difficult situation. When I meet with people, I don't delve right into, oh, my God, tell me what happened. We talk about them. We talk about their life. We talk about their interests, what they do, and then we gradually get into what happened to them. And I try to make it so that they don't focus the rest of their life on being, you know, a victim or survivor that has to come to court and talk about it. I tell parents of my kid victims, I say, listen, this isn't something that you can bring up every day. This isn't something that you have to worry about coming to court on every day, because the child is going to lose focus of all the other things that they're interested in, activities at school, their schoolwork. All these things tend to go down if they're thinking about the fact that they have to be in court and talk to a judge. So how I get through it is I try to find, you know, the silver lining in any of this, if there ever is. I try to make them feel comfortable. I feel as though I have a niche in talking to parents and talking to kids about this. And it's truly so rewarding when you do have a case and you are successful in your prosecution and that person is brought to justice and you've done it for somebody. I have so many victims that come back to me year after year that thank me, and it's so rewarding to hear people call me or write to me on Facebook or on Twitter and say to me, you know, thank you for helping me and helping me get through it. And that is a reward in and of itself.
And so how do you feel about the recent Me Too movement?
I think that the Me Too movement is serving a wonderful purpose in the sense that there is strength in numbers. And often in my cases, even in my big high-profile cases, if one person speaks out, it tends to make somebody else feel comfortable. There's many people that don't want to talk about this stuff. Even in this day and age, I told you that it's much more prevalent with the news and stuff like that. But there are still people that say, I can't do it. I can't go through with this. I can't go into court. I can't talk about my vagina. I can't talk about what he did or what he saw or what she did or saw, because there's female defendants, of course. But I think the Me Too movement has kind of put it in the minds of people to say, listen, if she can do it, I can do it. If he can do it, I can do it. I don't have to be ashamed. I don't have to be embarrassed. Maybe it was shameful at the time that it happened, and now it's going to be my time to speak up. Are there cases in which maybe some people are thinking this is great publicity? I don't know. I don't want to say that. I don't think. But I think, in essence, Me Too has made people believe that they can't bury their head in the sand anymore. This is a real crime. It really does happen. We really are suffering, and we need to do something about it. We need to stop it.
With more people speaking up, do you feel like things have changed in the way perpetrators are viewed in the last 30 years and then after the Me Too movement as well?
I haven't seen much of a change now because, you know, it's really pretty new. And so I don't see perpetrators saying, oh, you know what, she's right, and Me Too, and I'm going to confess to the crimes. I haven't seen any of that yet. It's really very, very new. But I don't think you're going to see that. I think for victims or survivors, it's excellent. I think it's a way for them to get their story out there, to speak about what happened to them. I don't know if many perpetrators would say, oh, well, now that she's involved in Me Too, I'm going to confess to what I did. So I don't really see a huge change as of yet.
And as a woman prosecutor, have you ever dealt with sexual harassment or misconduct yourself from coworkers or people you come across in your work?
I have to say that many years ago when I started in the courtroom, it was much more of a boys' club. It really was. There wasn't a lot of female prosecutors, not a lot of female lawyers going into the courtroom. So did I notice maybe a bit of chauvinism? A little bit. But I haven't. I have to say that honestly, I've never been the victim of sexual harassment. I've never been in a position where someone said to me, you know, if you don't do this, this is going to happen, or if you don't do this, you're not going to get a raise. So I'm very fortunate in that way, although we know so much of it does really go on. But in my position as a female prosecutor, and for doing this as many years that I have, I think I've ingratiated myself enough. I know these guys, you know, and I treat them with respect, and they treat me with respect. So, no, I am lucky that I haven't had to deal with it.
And in those decades, of course, the Internet became a thing. So how did the rise of the Internet change the world for prosecutors like you?
I think that now it's twofold. The Internet is great for a lot of things, and it's really bad for some of the stuff that we see. Certainly, access to sexually based information, including pornography, it's there. It's easy to get to, it's easy to find, and it's easy for perpetrators to trade pornography and stuff like that. So it's been good for us in the sense that we're always behind the curtain, behind the scenes. We're able now to track it, to see it, and to stop it. That's the bad side of it. The good side of it is if I have a case and I have kids that are using Facebook or MySpace or all of the websites, sometimes there's evidence on there. There's evidence that I can use in my case. Sometimes the perpetrator is talking to the victim or, you know, sending messages or doing all these things. So in that respect, evidentiary-wise, it's been helpful. With regard to seeing a rise and seeing girls starting earlier with sexually based information, I've seen much more of that. I do think that the trend is that our kids now are much younger, much more exposed to things that I was never exposed to as a child. And I think it's readily accessible to them, and it's easy for them to see it. I also think that a lot of the media has to do with, I think that a lot of it is glamorized. I think, you know, the fact that an older woman is having sex with a young student, you know, we go back to the Mary Kay Letourneau days, you know, they glamorized it. They made it look good. She was featured in every paper, which is fine just to show about the case, but then one of the magazines, one of the tabloids, you know, had her picking out her wedding dress when she was going to marry this guy. So it almost gives a effect that it's okay. It's already to do that. I've tried female teachers, and to get a jury on those cases is very difficult because a lot of the men on the jury were saying to me, why didn't I have a teacher like that? Why wasn't I exposed to that? You know, almost making it a rite of passage when it's really serious stuff. You know, it's really important, and it's really serious. But that's the twofold problem that you deal with in this case. You've got the internet that is fabulous for certain things, and it's really bad because of the exposure that it lets our kids have.
And you mentioned the media coverage and how much that's increased as well with the internet. So there was a story actually in yesterday's Miami Herald that had the headline, Florida's sex industry in a panic after feds shut down notorious Backpage website. I was wondering if you could explain for our listeners what exactly that website was and what are the implications of it being shut down.
Well, the Backpage website was always, we were always honed in on it because there was a lot of sex trafficking taking place. There were a lot of advertising on Backpage for young girls and girls to have meetings with and to see and to be with and escort services and things like that. That's what Backpage really turned out to be. We found that there were a lot of sex trafficking cases, a lot of sexual crimes that were taking place from the advertising on Backpage. So when they talk about the sex industry, that's the industry that they're basically talking about, maybe prostitution, sex trafficking, things like that. And like I said, we have had cases where the ads were running, the cases emanated from ads that were running on the Backpage. So certainly it's a moneymaker, and it's a moneymaker. It generates money for Backpage, for the website, and it was moneymaker for defendants that were involved in trafficking young girls. That's basically what their business cards were. So that's what the arrest we're thrilled about. It's great that it's shutting down Backpage. But for those that were involved, that were running ads, that were involved in sex trafficking, it's a big boo-hoo for them.
With it shutting down, though, could it push sex crimes further into the shadows? How will you be able to track them?
Yeah, I mean, listen, sex crimes are always in the shadow, but one advertising or, you know, it's going to pop up someplace else. Believe me, they're very smart. They know what they're doing. They know how to get these girls. And we have, you know, we have so many specialized teams now. You know, sex trafficking has become a very big industry in a lot of the states. And now we are specializing in certain units. Every police department now is specialized in sex trafficking. Certain prosecutors now are just dealing with sex trafficking. So I can guarantee you that even though this is shut down, it will pop up somewhere else and we'll be able to track it.
My guest today is Stacey Honowitz. She's been a supervisor in the Sex Crimes Unit at the Broward County State Attorney's Office for nearly 25 years. And she's author of two books on the subject of molestation that are specifically meant to be read with young children and help parents frankly discuss inappropriate touching with their kids and teach the importance of speaking up and reporting the abuse. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So, Stacey, we've been talking a little bit about trafficking, and I wanted to ask if What can someone do to try to be more aware and on the lookout, perhaps to try to prevent human trafficking if this is happening constantly in the shadows?
Well, listen, I always strive. My biggest goal in doing all of this is to educate, because if you don't educate young kids, they're never going to know. You know, knowledge is power. That's basically what it is. And if parents or teachers or coaches or anybody in a supervisory capacity is scared to talk to kids about what the consequences could be of their actions, then we're going to have these cases increasing. And so sex trafficking can occur anywhere. You know, you have young girls that sometimes are very, their mind is set on a glamorous life, and they think that answering an ad to be, let's say, a model or to go on a date, and things like this. This is how the trafficking basically starts. If they're not aware of the fact of what could happen if they're dealing with a stranger, it's in like in anything. It's not just the trafficking cases. It's the cases that we have over the websites and over the internet where young girls are talking to strangers on anything, on Facebook, on Instagram, and then they want to meet with the person. The person wants to meet with them and says to them, I could do this for you, I could do that for you. They have to be aware that you can't do that. You know, we were always told never to go with a stranger when we were growing up. I don't know why it hasn't stayed the same. I don't know why young girls seem to think that it's okay to be talking to someone over the internet or online, and that person says, why don't you meet me? Why don't you leave your house? Your parents don't really like you. I can do all these things for you. And they go. They get up and they go, and that's what happens. They get into trouble. They become victims of sex crimes, whether it's trafficking, whether it's sexual battery, lewd and lascivious. And that's why I stress talk and educate. You know, when these things are in the paper or these things are on the news, don't be afraid to show your child. Look what can happen if you do this. Look what happened to this girl. Read the stories. Read the articles. Read about how they were talking online. Read about how they left their home. And show them that this is, and then show them what the outcome is, that this is what happens, that you can get caught up in this, that you can then be trafficked. You can be taken. You can become a prostitute. He can send you various people. You can become a victim of sex crime. People are just too scared, I think, to really talk about the down and dirty. And they're only willing to talk about it once they end up in the state attorney's office or once they end up across the desk from a detective who's asking them a million questions. Parents and teachers and anybody needs to educate. I don't know what the fear is, but I can tell you there's a huge fear factor, and I see it even with my books. You know, my books are to teach little kids. You teach little kids all the time about every body part they have, their ears, their eyes, their nose. Why can't you tell them that's your vagina, that's your penis? No one can touch it. You need to tell me. No one can tell you that they love you and touch it. I mean, those are all things that lead a kid to learn early on that I cannot get involved in this. And if somebody makes me feel uncomfortable, if somebody writes to me online and says, take a picture of your vagina and send it to me, if someone writes to me online and says, your parents don't love you, come with me, that they're educated and they know that this is a recipe for disaster.
Well, Stacy, that's all the time we have, unfortunately. I'd like to thank my guest, veteran sex crimes prosecutor Stacy Honowitz. She's a supervisor in the Sex Crimes and Child Abuse Unit of the Broward State Attorney's Office. And as mentioned, she's the author of two books that seek to generate conversations between parents and their children about inappropriate touching. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today, Stacy.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we're speaking with a Naples teen who was sexually assaulted when she was 15. In the 4 years since, she's faced the perpetrator in court and has gone on to write a memoir about the experience. I'm Rachel Iacovone, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.